Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
The Green Line extension, it is pretty extraordinary how much it costs to put in a rail system that really goes as slow as the trains did 125 years ago.
Who wants to ride a system like that, not knowing whether you're going to get where you want to be safely?
Stunning news from Beacon Hill. Charlie Baker will become the next president of the NCAA.
Governor Deval Patrick, did you vote yet?
I did.
What'd you do on question one?
You better get out of my business. It's a secret ballot.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortslave, and Kim Kerrigan on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Tom Maroney. Kim Kerrigan in today for Joe Shortslave and Mazda on News. We'll hear from Janet Wu in just a few minutes. I see green across the major indices, just like the shoots of spring itself. A good day for the bulls. We'll have full reports throughout this program with our own Charlie Pellett. Now, let's get to it. In this hour, I was going to the train last night, and I'm out there on the platform. There's a man dressed up like some kind of Star Wars creature with a gun in his hand. A gun. I mean, probably a fake gun, but what did I know? I'm a journalist, so I was going to take his picture in case mayhem broke out. Well, you know what? Come to find out, he's probably in town for PAX East. Mm. This is a big video game convocation that brings out the lightsabers from around the U.S. It's big business, and Kim and I were talking about...
Not just
about
the lightsabers. That's not the only thing it brings out.
The people that are attached to them, right? And we're expecting more than 130,000 people here. We're going to talk to the vice president of Penny Arcade. It's the company that takes over the BCEC for this weekend. So this is a four-day event. Mm-hmm. And, oh, boy. And at 3:30, Boston City Councilor Brian Worrell will tell us why Boston needs another 250 liquor licenses. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, economic growth, I suppose. The councilor will make his case at 3:30. And Janet Wu went to see the CEO of AT&T, John Stankey, who spoke at the Boston College Executive Lunch Club today, a favorite of ours, a great lineup usually. Janet will tell us what he had to say about the company and about the outlook on mobile phone stock is up about 0.5%. Kim Kerrigan.
Sounds like a great hour. Then we move to our 4 o'clock hour, and I have to tell you, TikTok certainly been in the news. In fact, yesterday, you know, we talked about TikTok after the president and CEO went before a congressional committee. The issue is that a lot of politicians want to see the social media platform banned because of its attachment to mm-hmm. China.
Yeah.
Well, there is a woman who lives in Natick who does not want to see it banned, not because she gets dance lessons from it, not because she gets recipes or, you know, these kinds of things. It's because she's making quite a living on it. She is an influencer who has right at 10 million followers.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, she's one of the biggest
How
influencers.
Old is she?
I would say late 40s. 30s, early 40s, okay. Right? Yeah.
Great sense of humor. I talked to her a little bit today. Well, anyway, you know, I got a pitch later in the day that said the most famous TikTok couple in the universe, they have 3.8 million followers. I said to Kim, 3.8?
Sheesh.
I laugh at 3.8.
Right.
This woman in Natick has triple the amount.
So she's going to join us in our 4 o'clock hour. It's going to be a really fun conversation that you're going to enjoy. And Anne, what are you thinking about over there?
Well, big changes at South Station. I don't know if you commute in and out of the city, but they are building this enormous tower above it, which I'm going to tour in early April. But the MBTA board has approved a contract for infrastructure upgrades at South Station.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's great. There you go. Our producer found what might be the most annoying sound of all. That's Legend of Zelda. Yeah, that's right. So the volume goes up. This is why I love coming to work. But if you have seen strange creatures walking around Boston yesterday and throughout the weekend, there's nothing wrong with your sight or your television set or whatever. This is PAX East. It's a huge video game convocation. As much as I'd like to talk about the new iterations of Legend of Zelda, and apparently there is one, we want to talk about this as a big business story. More than 130,000 people for the next 4 days. Joining us now, Ryan Hartman is vice president of Penny Arcade. This is the company that oversees this event. And Ryan, welcome. I know you're in Boston. I know you're watching things as it happens. Why don't you set the scene for us first? Are you at the convention center, and what's going on?
Yeah, I'm actually, first of all, thank you for having me. And yes, I'm actually found a quiet room backstage as we're in the middle of running the convention as we speak.
So give us a sense of, Ryan, of how many people are there, just how big this convention is.
Sure. I mean, to try to put it in context, I mean, we do four PAX events a year. We do one in both Philadelphia and Melbourne, Australia. And our Boston show is our largest show, technically, by a virtue of how large this convention center is. The BCEC here in Boston is so massive that we are able to sell a little more tickets than we do to our other shows. I don't like to get into specifics just because I don't like people to compare show to show, but we will be over 100,000 attendees over the four-day weekend.
Yeah. Ryan Hartman with us, Penny Arcade. Tell us about your business. You're based in Washington, I believe?
Yes. Penny Arcade is based out of Seattle.
Seattle. So, and this is what you folks do. You go around and you hold these events.
Yeah, Penny Arcade is a bit of, for lack of a better term, a gaming media company. We do a lot of different ventures analogous to the gaming space. We've made a few games, but there's a lot of other things we do. The big thing we're probably known for is PAX, which is Penny Arcade Expo. It's a giant celebration of all things gaming. Every possible tangent to the gaming culture we try to cover here at these events.
And Ryan, who's attending?
Yeah, the average attendee is a pretty hardcore gamer. A lot of people who are really invested in the gaming as a hobby and as a culture come. And there's a lot of different things covered. There's a very, very large tabletop area, for example. So there might be folks who are only here to play board games, some that are only here to play PC games, some that only want to play console games or see the newest, you know, releases that are going to be coming out on the show floor, and then a ton of panel content and things along that nature.
Okay, so I think you're getting to where I was going to go with this, which is why people come to attend. Do they come to see the latest? Do they come to mingle with like-minded individuals? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, they definitely, I mean, coming to see and check out the newest games is definitely a part of it, but the biggest part that we have heard from fans that we try to propagate ourselves is being able to celebrate and enjoy something you like around like-minded individuals, right? People who are into the same stuff you are, that just want to relax and have a good time, and everyone here just is like, you know, there's something to be said for like sharing a hobby with other folks. Mm-hmm. And I will say I love hearing stories like some people will say, I have an online group of friends and we all play a certain game together and then we meet up in person at PAX. We all live on different parts of the country and we all fly into Boston and then meet here in person for a weekend. And stuff like that is just awesome here.
Ryan Hartman with us, Penny Arcade, runs this PAX East. He says one of the biggest of the four that they run out of Seattle, Washington. Ryan, I'm curious on the tourist business end of things. You've already said the BCEC is spacious enough for your event. What about the other accommodations in the city of Boston? Did you find that there were enough hotel rooms, the transportation was up to snuff, the restaurants? I mean, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I've been in the event space for 12, 15 years now. And when we look at doing a PAX or if I were to do any given event, especially if, for example, we were to launch a new PAX, that everything you mentioned is something that goes into consideration. You have to look at a venue that can not only accommodate your size, but also your prospective growth, like how big you plan on getting, enough hotels to accommodate a certain level of growth, infrastructure needs, a decent airport. Like, there are a lot of things on this checklist, like when you're prospective for a city, that will take it out of the running. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, Boston, like, has accommodated everything we would need for a PAX and then some. It is, I mean, obviously I'm, you know, speaking to a crowd that, you know, will like to hear this, but Boston is a great city for us. And it is perfect for like the scale and scope that we wanted to grow to.
And Ryan, we're just about out of time, but let me ask you about the vendors. How many vendors do you have here and what's in it for them? I'm assuming it's sales.
Yeah, I mean, we have hundreds of individual vendors and exhibitors here. And a lot of it is, the gaming space, one of like the headlines is always gaming as a space makes more money than film and TV, right? And a lot of folks want to find organic ways to connect with that kind of audience. So there's a lot of folks that are already within gaming that want to get in front of these kinds of customers. Mm-hmm. And there's some like non-endemic from the outside who want to come in. These are a passionate, interesting fan base, and they either want to connect with them on some sort of like branding level or like just standard retail, you know?
So Ryan, finally, are you in costume and the people we see in costume, are they dangerous?
I am not in costume, and no, everyone in costume here is very nice and very chill. And we also, because of video games, like some people will have like a fantasy costume where they might have like a staff or a sword. We also weapon check everything to make sure it's not harm, can't hurt anyone, can't, if you swing it, it won't hit. We have to make sure everything has to be like foam and soft and collapsible before you're allowed to bring it.
A cow in England named Doris has gone viral globally. She's a dairy cow on a large farm, and after the farmer, John Brody, takes out dozens of other cows for milking early in the morning, he has to go in and coax her out of the barn. Mm. She pretends to be asleep. Listen to this.
This is what a stubborn dairy cow looks like. Look, everyone's out. Everyone's getting ready for milking, except for Doris. Doris is actually pretending to be asleep. She isn't really asleep. Doris, come on. I see your ears moving. Come on, I can see your eye. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's so great.
John Brody, it's a very funny video on TikTok that has gone very viral. And it's hysterical. And everyone says, I feel so much like Doris.
Yeah.
This is my spirit animal.
Right.
Just pretending to sleep to get out of something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Leave me alone.
Let's go, Doris. And in her mind, she's thinking, well, what are you going to give me today to do it? Huh?
Right,
What's in it for me today? Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, that's really
so good.
Funny.
I'll be anxious to see. We should check and see if Doris has as many followers as our TikTok influencer coming up in the 4 o'clock hour.
That's a great question.
We'll see if she knows anything about her. All right, Ian, thanks very much. Another home rule petition from Boston is headed to Beacon Hill as the city seeks the state's approval to add 250 liquor licenses to specific neighborhoods over the course of the next 5 years. Joining us is one of the authors of that petition, Boston City Councilor Brian Worrell. And it's great to have you with us, Councilor. Tell us a little bit about your proposal.
Yes, thanks for having me. And this proposal just speaks to the need of liquor licenses in predominantly Black and brown neighborhoods that have been systemically and historically left out of the conversation for years. When we look at neighborhoods like Mattapan only has 8 out of the total 1,090 on-premise liquor licenses, and Blue Hill Ave has only 6. And when you compare that to neighborhoods like the Back Bay that have 80, the disparities send a clear message. And then when you look at the profit generated by those liquor licenses, which is typically 2 times the profit for restaurants, It just furthers and deepens the gaps in opportunity and wealth our communities already feel. And there's also a direct correlation between sit-down restaurants and liquor licenses and healthy food options. So this is also a healthy food initiative as well.
Mm-hmm. City Councilor Brian Worrell is with us. This proposal to really beef up the number of liquor licenses in 10 zip codes around the city. And as the councilor just said, they're really trying for economic development here. I'm curious, you know, you say the Back Bay, what, you said 80. I guess my question is, if you make these available in these neighborhoods that traditionally have had a low number, will you see them be snapped up? Will people use them?
Yes. So what we ended up doing was we did a survey of all of our main streets within some of those zip codes. And what we received back was 90% of current restaurant owners, because there's a lot of established businesses that are operating without liquor licenses, will say that they will take one. Mm-hmm. There's been businesses that have been operating for 20 years on takeout alone And just by just how great of an operator and great service and the great food that they served, they were able to expand. And some of them have the opportunity or the seating for sit down, but they don't have a liquor license in order to keep someone inside those seats.
Well, Counselor, that raises a question then. I mean, in other words, if they're ready and willing, why didn't they apply for one? Why didn't they get one before this? One of the things I can assume is that they weren't allowed. Are we talking about widespread, you know, redlining here?
Yeah. So what we have found is that liquor licenses are not available right now, and every year it sounds like there's a wait list. But every so often you have to reapply to be kept up to date on when the liquor licenses become available. So this way, with introducing the five liquor licenses per zip code over a 5-year period, we'll make sure that we'll be meeting the demand that's currently already there here in the city of Boston.
So, Councilman, they won't be offered up to other locations. So we can't add another one to Back Bay on these 250. It would just be in those zip codes, correct?
Yes. Okay. And we were being intentional and targeted on making sure that the areas that are receiving the liquor licenses have been the ones that have been historically left out of the conversation.
So, Councilman, is the situation still the same that if you have a liquor license, you can sell it to someone else who would want that liquor license? Does that still exist?
These liquor licenses are non-transferable.
Okay.
Which means when you sell your restaurant or are no longer in business, what they do is they go back to the licenses board, which is here in the city of Boston, and they stay with that zip code. So these zip codes will always have liquor licenses for any operator to come in and to establish a restaurant.
All right. So, Counselor, how much are these going to cost? What's the price point?
It's only the fees that operator will have to pay, and we have to just take a look at the fees that are out there and be an issue by the license.
Because as I understand, I mean, I go way back here in covering things Boston and otherwise, and I thought they were fairly expensive, no?
Right. So the transferable liquor licenses are the ones that have value. The non-transferable ones are the ones that don't have value.
Right.
So the transferable ones, I'm hearing new prices of $550,000. Mm-hmm. And we were taking a look at the numbers, and over the last 2 years, out of all the transferable liquor licenses that have moved hands, we saw that only two came into any of these zip codes that we have outlined in that home rule petition.
So, Councilor, what's it sound like up on Beacon Hill? I mean, is there a chance that this is going to go through? Will it go through?
Yeah, we are encouraged. We've had conversations with state reps and state senators, and we have a lot of buy-in and support, not only from the state senators and state reps that have these zip codes, but those in leadership positions as well. So we are encouraged, and we do have a new rep of the 5th Suffolk, Rep. Christopher Worrell, who we feel is going to be a good champion on this home rule petition.
All right. Well, Counselor, I mean, does the Alcoholic Beverages Control Commission have anything to say about this?
Yeah, so they were part of the conversation.
Okay.
And they're
good? Actually, they're signed off?
Yep. They've advocated and also spoke to the need of these liquor licenses in these neighborhoods.
Is there precedent for this? Has this happened in other parts of the Commonwealth? Where you've gone and said, we want, you know, X number more of these liquor licenses?
So this is something that Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley also has done with her time on the council. However, what we did a little different was to make sure that they were tied to a zip code and that these did not leave the zip code that needed the most.
So that's what held up her idea. She was making them transferable?
She was making them non-transferable, but they could go to different part of the town.
Right.
So although we had non-transferable, like you couldn't sell them to another person, they could still all end up on Dorchester Ave opposed to Blue Hill Ave, right? So we saw that Dorchester Ave received a lot more liquor licenses during that time, and now they have 24, where Blue Hill Ave, which is the predominantly black community and immigrant community, only has 6. And it's one of the longest. It's one of the longest streets here in the city of Boston, and it only has 6 liquor licenses.
So, Councilman, I mean, common sense tells us that, you know, you've already explained a lot of these things, that if you can have sit-down restaurants, if you can have, you know, better food options, if you can just have opportunities for people, it's going to bring more money. But have you guys done some research and maybe put some numbers to what this might mean for each of these communities?
Well, what we saw is those neighborhoods that are small business and are from the community are more likely to reinvest into themselves and hire from the neighborhood. So this is just also creating generational wealth. So the numbers, I don't know if we could put a number to it, but it just speaks to the impact that having a established community, locally owned business can do for the neighborhood. You're talking about years and years of reinvestment.
The Boston College Chief Executives Club back in business. They have been cited for this. One of the best, if not the best, lineups of CEOs in the country, and today was no exception. The CEO of AT&T in Boston today, far from his corporate headquarters in Dallas. He was guest speaker at this event. And Janet Wu is here in the 106.1 studios with all the details. Janet.
Indeed, as you say, AT&T is headquartered in Dallas, but it can actually trace its roots to Boston because, as you recall, in 1876, Alexander Graham Bell placed that very first call to his assistant, Mr. Watson, in the next room, and that room was here in Boston. The invention of the telephone was the foundation of the company that would become AT&T, which stands for American Telephone and Telegraph Company, although some of the younger set might be asking, telegraph, what's that? Of course, 150 years of innovation, consolidation, divestitures, acquisitions, breakups, marriages have made it a much different company. John Stankey has been with the telecom giant for 37 years. He rose to the top job during the pandemic in July of 2020. Now, there was a bit of an audio issue at today's lunch, not from AT&T, but just the mic system. But you can hear him talk about one of the biggest mandates of the company today, and that is bringing connectivity to all areas of the country.
The richest nation in the planet has 1/5 of U.S. households that don't have access to skilled internet, and that's a problem. It's a problem for economic opportunity, it's a problem for education equality, it's a problem for access to healthcare. Probably no surprise to any of you, we build infrastructure. $24 billion a year of investment last year. We're building fiber networks at a faster rate than anybody else in the United States. That fiber is going to be really important down the road.
As he said, it is an infrastructure company. Hundreds of billions of dollars being spent in this area. Again, that's AT&T CEO John Stankey, who was in conversation today with the CEO of John Hancock, Marianne Harrison, who recently announced her retirement. Stankey expressed congratulations and a bit of minor envy that she will no longer be dealing with the day-to-day company challenges. She asked him about his biggest concerns now and in the future. Climate was one of his answers. AT&T does business in the hurricane belt and in areas prone to wildfires and flooding.
Weather patterns impact our business pretty dramatically. We're paying a lot of attention to this, not only for the fact that I've got to engineer the business differently, invest differently to have resilience, to do things like support our FirstNet network, which in the state of Massachusetts is what fire departments and police departments use, ensure that they have communication all the time during public disasters. And we care about these weather patterns because if suddenly the average sea level rises a foot, think about all the infrastructure that we have on the ground. There are pieces of electronics that are generated, and suddenly they're, you know, going to get flooded.
and think about that loss and all the money for repairs, and also think about what the company does whenever we have one of the snowstorms here and they have to get people reconnected. He was asked about the outlook for the company, which had a pretty strong year last year. And of course, the company grew dramatically during the pandemic as people needed more telecom and internet services at home. Last year, AT&T had more than $120 billion in revenue. In the last 4 years, the company has invested more than $140 billion in wireless and what they call wireline networks. He did offer some guidance and outlook for the company.
We do expect sustainable growth in 23, and we've given guidance to that. 20% of our revenues go back into capital infrastructure that we're investing. Just to give you a sense, probably historically, 15-ish%, maybe in a high year would have been 16%. Dramatically higher investment levels because of these fundamental changes that we see happening in society that require great high-performance connectivity.
And he specifically spoke to the fact, something that we know and we cover quite extensively, all the people who are working at home now. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough to just be able to place a phone call. You have to have this high-speed connectivity to do a lot of the complicated work that's being done. You know, even a lot of people in services, in IT support, et cetera, are working from home. You heard him express concern that a fifth of American households do not have that high-speed internet. And this led to policy initiatives. President Biden also talking about this being a big part of the infrastructure plan. Hmm. Well, John Stankey says, we have come to a point that with current and public and private investment partnerships, he does believe that every American household could get connected. It didn't happen before because, again, it is a big investment. It was hard for companies to take on alone.
Well, interesting stuff. Did you, there's always a Q&A. I mean, did you have anything to say to the audience in particular? Marion, did she bring up anything that about the company?
Yeah, so again, some of the stuff that you heard, do they expect to grow as fast? What is the company investing in? It was pretty stunning that he did share that they are taking 20% of their profits to reinvest in the company. That is a really high rate for any company. Mm-hmm. And in past years, the highest would be about 15-16%. But this is an expensive business. You have to build that stuff, build the things underground. Now, the audience was a little bit smaller than pre-pandemic. I think people are tiptoeing still back into luncheons. But it is great to see this in person, as you said. One of the people in the audience was former police commissioner at Davis, because he was asking about those secure networks for first responders. I think this is really pertinent as we approach the 10th anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. During that time, we saw the communications and the stress that first responders had to go through. And John Stankey referenced that you know, they have to provide these services. It's not just residential services, but emergency departments and first responders do rely on their networks.
I'm curious. I think it's so fascinating you said one of the biggest challenges is climate, which, you know, seems to be a theme that we hear everywhere. Did he talk about losses to the company as a result of climate and some of the infrastructure issues that have occurred over the last couple of years as we've watched these hurricanes roll in and these kinds of things?
So he did not go specifically into the losses, but he did say, and I know the audio was a little hard, that he has to think about climate because it has to do with the strategy of his company. He said, he used the words, I have to engineer around this. I have to make this so we can deal with this because we're always at risk. And he specifically talked about the stuff that could be lost underground. I mean, when you think about the insurance companies and how they are dealing with this around as well, it is a problem. And we know of, we look at climate as, you know, injury to personal body and such, but it is really impactful to business and a huge, huge cost. And so what he did say is that they have to invest heavily in, and he used the word resiliency.
So, and I have one other follow-up here real quickly. He talks about the fact that he thinks every household in a, you know, can be connected. Does he talk specifically about which parts of the country are the least connected at this point?
Well, it's a surprise. It's not necessarily rural. He says a lot of what is lacking is all over and all different in different areas. And they actually have created a project that with some of the government programs, they have made it possible so that people can get connectivity for zero money. It involves a low-priced product plus the rebate that they would get from government programs. So this is something that hopefully we'll see a lot of progress in the years going ahead. And we've, of course, covered this not just with telecom, but with educational people that we've brought on board, saying that especially during the pandemic, we saw students that were not able to access their lessons and stuff. We saw them going to parking lots of fast food chains. So this is something that he says it's really critical for the country. He also did mention, television entertainment. But he said, first of all, it's economic opportunity and educational opportunity.
Sure. If the world was ending, you'd come over, right?
False.
You'd come over and you'd stay the night.
Oh, it's horrible to would travel you, if the world is ending.
Would you love would me for the hell of it? All our fears would be irrelevant.
Hey, no boys allowed.
All right, no boys allowed. Now, you're listening to what may be, this age's newest comedy team, husband and wife. That's Sheena Melwani and her husband. Now, let's get a little explanation in order. They have 9.4 million followers on TikTok, and they live out there in Metro West, and she plays the piano, as you can hear. She has a wonderful voice. And her husband is usually off camera with his snide and snarky remarks, and it's hilarious. And we've asked Sheena to join us now, and she is, not only for her business, and this is just fascinating in itself, but there's a lot of controversy. This week, Congress seemed to be leaning towards some kind of regulation or crackdown on TikTok. Sheena, welcome to this program. So glad to have you with us. We've been enjoying your TikToks this afternoon. I remember, I'm going to leave this one more remark. I said, Kim was watching the TikToks, and you said to me, well, she's not going to get any work done. pretty confident.
Was I right?
You were right. You were certainly right early in the day.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all the hours that two of you lost today. But thank you for having me on the show. I just want to start by saying I really appreciate the opportunity.
9.4 million viewers. I mean, explain the trajectory, when you started and how you landed here.
I don't even know how we got here. It was one of those, like, completely by fluke. That clip that you played, I happened to gather that little piece of content completely by fluke. It was the most natural and organic piece of content that I have ever put up. I was at the beginning of the pandemic, like everybody else, I was stuck at home and not really knowing what to do with my time, with my life, with myself. And I turned to music, which is my base is music. I'm a singer and songwriter. And I turned to music and I would go live on Facebook and I would sing to people, my friends, my family. It was a small group of people. And I was like a human jukebox. And so one night after I had done this live show where people would come and bring me their request in real time, that was sort of my way of coping. And that was my way of sharing myself with the world or with my family. And I was like, we can do this together, guys. We can get through this. And one night I finished my live and I started filming this small piece of content to post on Instagram the following day. And my husband didn't realize that I was filming. And so he just started like interjecting. He had no idea that the camera was on. He had no idea what the song was. And he was just like, what are you saying? That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. The world is ending. You stay in your house.
So, Sheena, this is what, I think is really fascinating about it. I mean, you have a fabulous voice, and we could all sit and watch you all day. But now we have this second voice, and it's that of your husband's. Mm-hmm. We don't see him. We just hear him. He's just the dad in the background. But he's gone one step further. He's the Indian dad in the background. So explain to everybody what that's all about, because it really does feel very organic.
Well, it came from that song. That was the first song that actually kind of started this without even us realizing that it was starting. We didn't know what would happen to that particular song. But as I posted it, it was like, oh, well, everybody's Indian dad would say something like this, not really realizing that people would think that he was my Indian dad, And, you know, he finished by saying, no boys allowed, no boys ever in this house, nobody's coming over. Meanwhile, the rest of my page had videos of my kids and I'm wearing a wedding ring and all of the content. So I never assumed that people would think he's my dad. He's Indian dad to our two kids, and that's why we created that that name and that sort of character.
Right, right.
And when you I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say he's a partner at one of the city's, you know, one of the city's fancy firms.
Yes.
And, you know, that's why he's off camera. I don't think his clients would really appreciate right. knowing
what he's having at night with his wife. But when he is on, Sheena, you know, explain that. He has kind of a cartoon face or an avatar face.
Exactly. It was just one of those, again, it was one of those things that came out of a necessity. People kept asking, you know, who is this guy? What is the story here? We want to see. And we're like, well, he wants to maintain a little privacy. And I was okay sharing more of myself, but he just wanted to do what he wanted to do. And he also didn't want to jeopardize his position at his career . And so it was just, this is what worked for us. And, and it was a fun little, like, here's us having a good time and not taking this so seriously when everybody was so serious, you know?
So, Sheena, of course, we're a business program, so we want to talk to you
course.
About... Well, no, no, no.
Yeah,
I mean, this is lovely, but we want to talk about the business of all of this. So, I mean, clearly, TikTok has changed your life, right?
It has. It has. And I will say, I came to TikTok not really understanding that it would change my life as far as my business was concerned. I had been on social media in the past, and I stopped that to stay at home and have a family and to be home with my kids. And then, you know, just before the pandemic hit, I said, well, let's see what the social media landscape looks like. But TikTok was never really in my periphery, if I'm being completely honest. And I was going to stick to more Instagram and, you know, who knows. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, when I had this piece of content and I threw it up on TikTok, and then we realized its potential. We put up a second and a third, and then realized, wait, hold on, there's something here. And then we started trying to understand what that something was. And we built and we built and we built and we built. And I wish I could have told you in that moment, like, oh, everything's going to be fine. I'm going to grow this to a business of 9 million followers, and I'm going to be speaking with brands like P&G, Kiehl's, Bose, and it's going to change my life and the economics of my life. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have known that, but I have to say, like, I did not plan this. Mm-hmm. This was it was a beautiful way of, you know, life unfolding.
And it all unfolded. Sheena, let's talk a little bit more about the economics. I don't understand. I mean, I vaguely understand this. So how do you have sponsors now and they pay you? How does this all work?
Right. So I put content together daily. I create little clips daily.
Just one or more than one?
Sometimes it's multiple. Most of the time it's one. In the beginning, maybe we used to do more than that. Mm-hmm. We do short form and we do some long form on other platforms. And, you know, it's just one of those things that people come to my page now on a daily basis to see what I've got, to see what I've got going on, right?
Okay.
So brands will pay for that viewership. They want to get eyeballs on their content as much as they can. So they will pay influencers or they'll pay content creators to get those eyeballs. Mm-hmm. So I might play a prank on my husband. I've played a prank before where I swapped out the toilet paper from our regular Charmin and I put in like just a random roll that I bought of like kitchen roll and, you know, and it was just this hilarious little piece of content. But it all came back to the fact that, well, everybody loves Charmin in our house, you know?
So what happened there? So that's Procter & Gamble, right?
Yep, that's Procter & Gamble.
So they, what did they pay you for that one instance, or are you on kind of a retainer?
No, so, I mean, you can do it a collection of ways, but in this particular instance, I worked with Procter & Gamble to create a piece of content that they were happy with, and then I executed on that one piece of content, right? There's a lot that goes into it. You kind of storyboard the whole thing. then you send it to them. Their people look at it, they send it back, okay. They approve it and all of that. Mm-hmm. There are tons of, there's legalities that I have to work with. And I know a really good lawyer, so it works to my advantage.
Yeah. he's usually
close by.
Sheena, listen, I know everybody will ask you, and I'm going to ask you now, how much do you make on this?
Oh, come on, man.
Well, all right. Here I knew that was going to be an oh, right. Come on, man moment. But
can you get us in the ballpark?
Ballpark.
Sheena? I mean, is this
50 grand a year?
It's all over the map, I'll tell you that. But yes, I can live off of this.
Okay.
I can live off of the salaries that the money that I earn off of these things.
Is this making you millions?
No, it's not making me millions. Definitely not. But the potential is there. I will say the potential is definitely there. And I'm really selective. I have to say, I feel very fortunate that my life does not depend on this. But I feel very fortunate that I can pick and choose the brands that I want to work with. I pick companies that I align with in my values. And so I may not necessarily do every single brand deal that comes my way. I'll pick and choose maybe one a month, but I feel confident as a woman that I can work on my business my own way. And so this TikTok ban really scares me, you know?
So that's, unfortunately, we're about to run out of time. We could have had you the entire hour to talk about this, but you are concerned about the TikTok ban.
Of course. Yeah. At this point, I could lose 70% of my audience.
Sure.
70% of... Yeah. I mean, imagine if you lost 70% of your listeners. How would you feel? Emotionally,
sure.
Financially, everything. It's just, I didn't have a social media following before April 2020, but of my total 13.5 million followers, 9.5 almost are on TikTok.
There is an asteroid headed our way. It's called Dizzy, DZ2 2023.
Mm-hmm. These always just roll right off your tongue, the names of these asteroids.
It will get very close, unusually close to Earth, but it will not crash into us this weekend.
There we go.
Oh, listen to that. We got some sound effects. Thank you, Pete, our producer. Okay, can I tell you about this first? Because this is really interesting. Yeah. Newly discovered asteroid, safely whizzing by this weekend at some point, 115-foot rock. So if it did hit us, they say it wouldn't take out a city, but it would take out a large town.
Yeah.
It's going to be coming by at 17,000 miles per hour.
Gee willikers.
Asteroids of this size only happen about once a decade, and they tend to get no closer than the orbit of the moon, but it's going to come within less than half the distance from the Earth to the moon. Now, how can you see it? Technically, you could use a large telescope, but by far the easiest way is to watch live streams from robotic telescopes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, Kim updates us on these, too. One of these days, one of these is going to get through.
So let me just say this. I don't know if it's that we're just all, or I personally am a little more sensitive to it, but it just seems like since that movie, Look Up.
Yeah, right?
That was filmed in our building, by the way.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
What? That there are more of these?
Yes! We're hearing about asteroids
the big balloon incidents and they changed the aperture on the...
Yes!
And all of a sudden we're seeing all this stuff.
Right. I am telling you. I don't know. It's... Yeah. Well, this one's not going to hit us, and that's good because it's very large. Yeah. We'd rather it didn't. All right. It's been a labor of love for Jose Rodriguez, our next guest, designing a clothing line to make the lives of those living with autism easier. Jose is a Babson College student whose little brother, Joel, is on the autism spectrum. Mm. He's joining us now, and Jose, it's certainly great to have you with us. We want to ask you why you felt compelled to start TASM, which is this clothing line for people who are living with special needs.
Yeah, well, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. The reason why I started TASM was because the need to help my brother's day-to-day obstacles was a part of me since as long as I can remember. Hmm. So when I was 16 years old entering this like business class, and they asked us to create, some makeshift startup just so that we can apply, the cost structure and all the different, like, very basic, business things to that. That way we can apply what we're learning to something real. I thought it was a no-brainer. instantly, I knew I wanted to create something to help his day-to-day life. And that led to, you know, me sitting down at the drawing board thinking, like, what are things that he does every single day that could improve based off of product or service?
Wow. And so, yeah, Jose, tell us about those. Give us some examples of what we're going to find in your product line.
Yeah, so my brother, growing up, he was fidgeting all the time, more specifically with his fingers, kind of like treating them as action figures. So when I was in high school, I did a project on how to best help those with autism in the classroom setting. And that's when I came across fidget toys. So fidget toys have been around for decades, and they help reduce stress and anxiety while sharpening focus. But if you know anything about anyone who has autism, sometimes, most of the time, it's extremely hard to keep track of small things, no matter how essential they are. So, me knowing my brother and how strict he is with his routine, I had to figure out a way to implement these quality fidget toys into his life, but in a seamless way. That way he doesn't forget them, but then also that way it doesn't mess up his already existing routine. Mm-hmm. And then that's when I created fidget-infused apparel, and I put a grommet at the end of a shirt, attached a carabiner clip to it, got a fidget toy keychain, and created that invention.
I love that. That is fantastic. We're talking with Jose Rodriguez, and he is a Babson student, and he has created this wonderful clothing line to make life easier for people who live on the autism spectrum. So talk to us about Babson and how that's helping you to get this line out there, get it marketed, and make a business out of it.
Yeah, Babson has, I want to say, it's exponentiated my growth. You know, I've grown so much in this short amount of time. I've only been here roughly 2 years now. We're closing in on the second year. And it's just, I could have never thought that I'd be at this place this fast, this soon. And I think a big part of that is because at Babson, outside from the classes that you learn, where you learn, like, you know, market segmentation and like I was saying earlier, like cost structure and operational things, it's more about the environment. You know, it's a small school, only 2,500 students, and it feels like almost every single student has something going for themselves, whether it's a side hustle or they have their own startup. Some students come in here with $1 million valuation for their startup, right? Some don't even need to go to school, and they just come here because they wanted to. And because it's such a small school, everyone knows everybody. So it has this family-like environment, and the coolest part is how you know, everyone is accessible. So you get tips and tricks from the person to your left and right.
Yeah.
And we do this all day, every day. I remember my very first day at Babson, I was talking about business movies, which is like back where I'm from. Like, that's like, I didn't even speak on things like that.
Business movies. What's your favorite? What's your favorite business movie?
Oh, The Founder, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, that's great.
We're with Jose. Hey, let's tell folks, we're with you, Jose Rodriguez. You're at Babson. I want to tell people how you got there. You won a 2020 National Youth Entrepreneurship Challenge, and were awarded this full tuition scholarship here. How far along is your business? Are these clothing products out there now for people to purchase? Yeah. Are you online? Fill us in.
Yeah, so in 2020, I took my idea. Actually, too, I want to throw in there how Tassium, the word Tassium, is autism scrambled. So that's a hidden gem. But how I got here was I joined into this business plan competition with 20,000 other students. And then through coming out on top, I was able to get some startup funds. So immediately, I went and patented and trademarked everything that I had to, and started producing. Like, it was me making shirts with a heat press and some vinyl, but I was producing to friends and family. And then, you know, from there, I got the scholarship. And once I came to Babson, the summer coming into Babson, I got my first manufacturer, mm-hmm. and I made a website. It was bad, but now it's decent.
What is the website, Jose? What's your website?
PassionWorldwide.com. So anyone can go and order. Right now we have shirts. We're working on hoodies and sweaters. Even though it's getting hotter outside, we want to have more options for families because they just love the product. And we are, anyone can order right now. You'll receive it in 2 weeks at most.
Now, I'm looking at you right now on television. There was a feature on you on Inside Edition last year. Did that help your business?
Oh, my goodness. I want to say prior to that, we were building the foundation. And at that moment when we had the opportunity to go on Inside Edition, it was like we finally really built a business at that point.
That's great.
You know, because now we had 400 orders overnight, you know, over 1,500 people in an email list. And now we have to work. Now we have to figure out how do we, you know, take care of our customer, nurture them, and build this community and deliver, right? Which is we did that before, but on a way smaller scale. Yeah.
Hey, Jose, we're all out of time. How's your brother doing, Joel?
Ah, man, he's doing awesome. He's graduating high school this year.
Wonderful, and he's wearing, I imagine, some of your clothing.
Oh yeah, all day, every day.
Hold the presses. This just in.
Here's a news flash.
Boss, head man, top dog, big cheese.
In business news, 3M and M&M have merged to form Ultradyne Systems.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
All right, it's time for our top story. And today it is related to the banking situation. Deutsche Bank fell by the most in 3 years, and the cost of insuring its debt against a default rose in a sell-off that Citigroup analysts describe as irrational. The bank, which has staged a recovery in recent years after a series of crises, was the biggest loser among large European bank stocks today after announcing a plan to repurchase debt, a move normally seen as a sign of strength. And that is your top story at this hour.
What's your favorite kind of food?
Pizza.
Oh, man. You can't eat pizza.
Why not?
Yeah, no. It's like probably one of the worst things you can eat.
All right, I'm cutting this off right now. It's clear you're an idiot and deserve no more of my time.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
When you end the week with Dino, you know you're doing something. We're going to talk about the best pizza cities in America right now as formulated by Clever Real Estate. It's a research firm, and it's more. Let's bring in our guest. Matt Brennan works at Clever Real Estate. He put together the metrics and so forth to come up with this. Boston coming in. Of all the cities in the U.S., Matt, Boston comes in at what number?
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Boston is the number 3 pizza city in the country, I'm happy to report.
Yeah. So I'm not lifelong, but I'm a longtime New Englander and Bostonian. And as much as I defend us tooth and nail about most everything, we had a discussion earlier about the Red Sox wanting to patent the word Boston, which is an outrage. Given my credentials as a true blue patriot of the city, I'm surprised at that because I often say to myself, why don't we have any good pizza around here? So tell me where I went wrong.
Wow, I'm surprised to hear you say that. Well, yeah, there's a few great reasons why Boston is an incredible pizza city. It's truly the upper crust of the pizza world in the United States.
I'll we heard what you did there. We heard that.
I might have a few more of them coming down the pipe. Boston, yeah, it might be a surprise. It ranks number 3 on our list of the best pizza cities behind number 1 Detroit and number 2 Hartford, Connecticut. Now, you might be wondering why isn't New York or Chicago up there?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that this study looked at more than just what people think about how pizza tastes. It looked at a bunch of different statistical metrics for ways you can measure a city's pizza scene. For example, we looked at Yelp reviews for restaurants. We looked at the number of pizza places per capita we did a poll of 1,000 Americans and asked them about their favorite pizza cities and factored those in. We looked at pizza prices and we looked at pizza passion. How often are people searching the web for pizza-related terms in the given cities? And out of all 50 cities, Boston was number three.
Well, maybe, Matt, you could break some of that down for us. Give us an idea of how many pizza joints do we have per capita?
Sure. Yeah, Boston has 12.3 pizza places per 100,000 residents. That is almost 50% more than the average city we studied, which has 8.4 for 100,000 people. These numbers, the 50 cities are the 50 largest metro areas in the U.S., so Boston ranks pretty highly in that metric. Boston actually ranks above average in every single metric we examined, all six metrics. Ranked above average in the average Yelp rating for pizza restaurants with 4.02 stars out of 5.
Wow.
And it ranks number 11 in terms of pizza passion. That's how often people are searching the web for pizza terms. It ranks number 10 in our poll that we did. We asked 1,000 people, hey, can you name the top 5 best pizza cities in the country? And 15% of the people we surveyed listed Boston within their top 5. And that put them in the top 10 in that particular metric. But like I said, there's a lot of metrics. That one is just one piece of the pie, if you will.
One piece of the pie. Matt Brandon is with us. Clever Real Estate is his firm, and we're talking about a survey. And as Matt said, these are, you know, we have it laid out here. We won't go into the details, but they have a fairly complicated set of metrics here. So, Matt, I will say this. I'll correct myself in this way. I can find good pizza. We just had one move into our town. It's on the gourmet pizza side. And I tell this story. I've told it quite a bit. I'll tell you. We ordered a large and a small, and I was sent to pick it up. And I get to the cashier, and she said, that'll be $42. And I said, whoa. Two pizzas, $42. So talk to us a bit about the price, the average price of a pie as it stacks up to others.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I am surprised. That definitely sounds like it was probably a gourmet pizza place, a little bit on the high end for a large and a small. You know, there's been a lot of talk about banking on your program, and I'm happy to report that for the most part, Boston's pizza prices won't break the bank. The average price of a large pizza in Boston is $20.33 for a pepperoni pizza. That may sound like a lot to some people, but it's actually below average in terms of the 50 largest metro areas. It's 7.2% cheaper than the average, and the same can be said for a cheese pizza, about $17 for a large pie, and that's about $11 cheaper than the national average.
Hey, Matt, when you were doing this survey, did people talk about pizza and what they like when it comes to pizza? Did you learn anything about that? You know, do people prefer a thin crust or a thick crust or, you know, pepperoni or whatever?
That is a great question. I don't know if we answered that particular question, but we got pretty close in something that we did with the Google search analysis. We looked at what types of pizza varieties are most popular in each city, and Boston showed up in that ranking a few times. Boston is the number 2 city in the country for search volume for Greek pizza. I did a little bit of searching myself and found that there's a lot of places serving Greek pizza in Boston, and Boston is number 4 in the country for search interest in pizza bagel.
Really?
No. Matt, listen.
Wait, I'm going to look up.
I have a standard order of pizza, and there's some things I won't have on my pizza. And this brings us to the great Hawaiian pizza debate, or if you will, the pineapple debate. I believe there's pineapple, there's ham sometimes, there's, you know, God, there's some volcanic lava, I believe, to make it very authentic. I mean, what about the pineapples? Did you get into that sort of thing in the survey?
You know, that is the type of question that is simply too explosive to poll a survey like this.
Hey, tell us a little bit about your firm, what you guys do.
Yeah, thank you for asking. We are a real estate data firm. We do plenty of studies on real estate topics and also, you know, both heavy topics about the difficulties of home ownership and how much that costs, but also lighter studies like this pizza study, for example. Mm-hmm. We also did one on the best coffee cities which found that Boston is the number three coffee city in America. So
what a coincidence.
We love a good coffee alongside our pizza here.
We're into drugs and junk food.
It's a great year for Boston food and beverages. You know, I heard the weather report. It's a little cold over there. So warming up with some pizza and coffee
sounds
like a great call. Yeah. But if your listeners are interested, they should follow us on Twitter at ListWithClever. We post a bunch of interesting stuff. And we also help people who are moving around the country. We help them find a great real estate agent if they don't know where to look at a great price. So there's a lot of benefits to Clever.
Fantastic. All right, Mr. Brennan, you've brought a little bit of sunshine, a slice of sunshine to our program today. We appreciate it. And there he goes,
Matt
Brennan. Let's talk about...
By the way, do you know what a Greek pizza is? Should I tell you real quickly?
Please.
All right, so on a Greek pizza, there's feta. There's olives, so there's peppers, there's red onion, there's a bit of artichoke, and then you can, make various other things, but it doesn't sound too bad. No. I can see where we're
looking
for
that. You had me at, artichoke, no. I mean, there is a distinction to be made, though, however, Kim. That's a Greek pizza because it has Greek ingredients on it. But then there are a number, and I'm sure you're aware, a number of pizza parlors that are run by folks of Greek ancestry.
That's true.
And they will
too.
Make you anything you want.
Absolutely. We've got a couple of them up my way.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, good.
All right. Let's talk about a very good week. I thought we had some good interviews.
We sure did.
Yeah. All right.
It was a good week.
Let's talk about Monday. There's always Monday to be concerned with. They have Seth Moulton, the congressman who comes on this program on a regular basis. We wanted to talk to him about the imminent appointment of a new leader for the MBTA. The governor said recently it was coming very, very soon, and I know he's got a lot of thoughts about that.
Yes.
So. Also, Mr. Moulton, we'll ask him about what's going on in Congress, what's going on with the former president. We spent some time on Donald Trump this week and some of the investigations. You know, is there any work getting done in a gridlock Congress that has this also kind of on the sideline? So.
Yeah. In fact, Monday, just for our listeners, is the next time that possibly we could learn more about the Manhattan Federal Court and that grand jury there who has been questioning situations with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So we could learn more about a possible indictment on Monday.
We have Brian Kane as well. He's head of the MBTA Advisory Board. John Chesto will join us. He's written a story about the Boston Private, this bank that was bought ultimately by Silicon Valley Bank. And Boston Private did a lot in affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So you see where Chesto's going with this. The connection is, what does this do for the
Absolutely.
Affordable housing initiative here in the Boston area? And that'll do it. We'll certainly have much more for you as we get here on a Monday. Everybody, enjoy your weekend. Kim Kerrigan, was a
Thank
pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Joe Shortsleeve, scheduled to return next week. We look forward to Mr. Shortsleeve's return. Bloomberg Wall Street Week starts right now.